Welcome to the SearchNetworkingChannel.com podcast. I'm Matt Donnelly, Associate Editor with TechTarget's Channel Media Group. My guest today is Tom Limoncelli. Tom is an internationally recognized author and speaker on many topics, including system administration and time management. A system administrator since 1988, he has worked for companies including Google and AT&T. He's best known for his books, The Practice of System and Network Administration, and Time Management for System Administration. Today, Tom and I will be discussing how to design networks for speed and reliability. This is part two of a podcast. The earlier podcast is available on our website, searchnetworkingchannel.com. Tom's put together two sets of questions. The first set that we reviewed in an earlier podcast covers those questions that a service provider should ask a potential customer when planning a network design project. The second set of questions, which we'll be discussing in today's podcast, address the key points that you as a service provider need to understand about network design. Together, these two sets of questions can be used to build the framework for a customer's network design project. Tom, welcome to this SearchNetworkingChannel.com podcast.
Sure.
Well, Tom, now we've covered the questions that a service provider should be asking their clients contemplating a network design or redesign for speed and reliability. And now we want to move to those questions that are those answers that VARs themselves should know as they contemplate such a project. And the first question that comes to mind that we should discuss would be the physical considerations. What should a VAR be looking at there?
There are many physical considerations to take into account. Some are specific to LAN or WAN, some are general. So specifically to LANs, what kind of copper are you going to run to the desk is one of the first questions. There's different categories of copper cabling, Cat5, Cat5e, Cat6. These are all the better ones can run higher speed networking, but they cost more. Personally, I believe that wiring is usually a 30-year investment in a building. So I usually tend towards the higher quality networking, because even though we might all be doing 100 meg to the desktop today, gigabit to the desktop tomorrow is very common. In fact, I'm seeing that becoming the bare standard now, and even faster in the future. But sometimes the customer says, you know, this office, we're renting it for 12 months, and then we're definitely moving. If there's new construction, what I find is that the cost of running wiring is dominated by the cost of construction. So if the walls are going to be opened up because it's new construction, it doesn't matter if you're running Cat5 or 6. The walls are open. That's the expensive part. Run the best stuff you can. There's an old industry jargon called once the walls are open, you might as well run dead presidents, which means the cost of construction is so much that if you've punched holes in the walls to run wires, you might as well run $20 bills, you know, in a line. That's not going to be your major cost. Construction will be. Then there's other physical considerations like labeling. Labeling sounds like a very simple, unimportant issue, but actually it's incredibly important to the maintainability of a network. So it's important to come up with a consistent scheme for labeling the jacks. Sometimes you label them like room number plus jack, or they might be labeled per run. So if you have multiple jacks in an office, there becomes some kind of numbering scheme. If you're subcontracting wire out to a company that does that kind of thing, often they'll have preferred schemes or recommendations based on the design of the building. Or sometimes companies have numbering standards. Wiring closets should be numbered also. We'll talk about wiring closets more in a little bit. And then within a computer room, if you've been asked to build a network that's in a computer room, that kind of labeling structure is important. I tell the engineers that I work with that if a machine is unlabeled, I'm allowed to power it off, because I don't want dangerous equipment in my machine room, and an unlabeled piece of equipment is just an accident waiting to happen.
And another question really that VARs should be asking themselves that seems to come up over and over is the question of network topology. What is the network topology?
Network topology topology is really the core of your design. So it's the shape of your network. So typically the topology or shape of a LAN, if we follow from the network jack to the deepest part of the network, typically you have a jack or multiple jacks in every office. That cord or bundle runs to a wiring closet known as the IDF, Intermediate Distribution Frame. In other words, a wiring closet. The placement of your IDFs is important because Ethernet has length limits. So usually IDFs have to be, or every jack has to be within 100 meters of an IDF. So for larger buildings, you might need multiple IDFs. Then you join the IDFs by linking them together, usually to an MDF, a main distribution frame. And often you have one MDF per building. They connect to the IDFs over fiber because fiber has longer length limits. If you have multiple buildings, then you have to figure out how to connect the MDFs. And so this all creates a large tree structure, which is the topology of your LAN. WANs are very different. WANs are usually just a few number of links connecting large locations, large or smaller locations. So WAN topology is a little different. Actually, it's similar. It's often a tree, but it's usually talked about in terms of a star topology is very common. So you want to look at what your traffic flows are, because that's often going to determine your WAN topology. So maybe most of your core applications are running in the company's headquarters, and then you have all these satellite offices that are going to be accessing those applications. So a typical topology in that situation is what's known as a star pattern. So this topology looks like a star pattern with the headquarters in the middle and offices radiating out from there. Very large WANs often have a hub and spoke model where there's multiple stars. So maybe you have one star per continent or per region, and all of those stars are joined together either in a line or in a circle. Now, that's the physical topology. That's really the physicality of it, how the wires are and pieces of equipment are connected. The other topology you have to consider is the logical topology. It's common to build an overlay network over the physical topology, and this overlay network might be segregated into VLANs or sometimes even different protocols, but usually you have different VLANs that overlay on top of your physical protocol. So in a LAN, your jacks might be assigned to various virtual LANs. So you might have the engineering VLAN, the sales VLAN, the guest VLAN, a VLAN for your servers. They're all going over the same trunk lines, but logically, the routers keep the packets separate. And these VLANs have to be routed together, and this is your logical topology. I can't stress enough to not go crazy by allocating a million little VLANs. I find fewer is better, simpler is better. It's also important to keep your VLAN IDs consistent. So if VLAN 100 is your engineering VLAN, you should probably use that VLAN ID in every building so that your engineers don't get confused. You know, is it 500 in this building and 600 in that building or vice versa? You're going to prevent a lot of errors by doing a little bit of planning in advance. A common pattern that I see is to have, say, engineering be 500, non-engineering be 600, servers being 700. And if you need multiple engineering networks, for example, they're 500, 501, 502. The other thing that I recommend as far as VLANs is that while you might use the same VLAN identifier in multiple buildings, I've never seen a design that had a VLAN spanning multiple sites that didn't later regret it. It's just sometimes I wonder why vendors provide this feature. But a VLAN is commonly a broadcast domain, and broadcasts need to travel within a certain amount of latency. So having a VLAN that is bridged between New York and LA usually doesn't work very well because of latency problems. So while you might have a VLAN number 500 might exist in New York, and in LA, those should be considered separate networks and routed instead of switched.
Hmm. Now, Tom, you've already been talking a lot about routing in the section of the podcast, and that really segues nicely into another question that service providers should really know the answer to as they plan and design networks for speed and reliability. And that question is, what routing protocols will you use?
So we have these different VLANs or network segments, and the routers need to know how to route between them. Because these segments come and go, we can't just use some kind of static configuration. Actually, that's not true. There is a routing configuration called static routing, where you just hand-configured every router to know how to get to every other network. And it's common in very small networks, less than, say, 5 routers. But once you get larger than that, you're going to need to pick a routing protocol to manage those routes for you. Two very common ones are OSPF and EIGRP. There's trade-offs between the two. OSPF is an open standard. It's supported by many vendors. And EIGRP has some benefits over OSPF. It's a little faster often for when there's a link down. EIGRP is often faster to converge. But EIGRP is only available on Cisco routers. So if you use EIGRP, you're locked into Cisco products, while OSPF will improve your ability to choose from a diversity of products, a diversity of companies.
Now we've talked a little bit about routing protocols, and that brings up another question about network monitoring, another question that service providers really need to be thinking about as they're starting to design these networks. How will the network be monitored?
Monitoring is really important, especially if you're committing to some kind of SLA, then you need to monitor that network to be able to demonstrate that you're meeting that SLA. A network that isn't monitored is just a pile of equipment. I tell this to people all the time. There are two kinds of monitoring, and both have different purposes, and both will help you with different reasons. But the historical monitoring and real-time monitoring. Historical monitoring tracks some characteristic of your network over time. So, for example, one characteristic is what's the utilization on a particular pipe. Maybe you're recording how full that pipe is every 10 minutes, and over the course of the year, you can build a graph that lets you plan for the future and see, you can even eyeball it often on a graph. You look at a graph and you say, well, at the angle of the line, you can see that we seem to be growing about a half an inch on my computer screen every month, and that means we're going to run out of capacity in 6 months. And if it takes 6 weeks to order more capacity, you can practically pick the date at which you need to order more capacity. And this is a lot better than running into the situation where the customer calls and says, hey, the network's crap. We seems to be overloaded. You notice that it is overloaded now. You say, well, I can fix the problem. It's going to take 6 weeks to order more capacity. So historical monitoring helps you prevent that kind of situation. Some other things that you might want to, do historical monitoring on are utilization and congestion. Don't go wild and try to collect every bit of information on every possible link. I think it's important to pick your WAN connections and maybe your trunk lines, and maybe some key servers, and monitor those lines for utilization and packet loss, and that'll do you just fine. The other kind of monitoring is what people often think about first when they think about monitoring. That's real-time monitoring. That's detecting if something up or down. So basically, real-time monitoring tells you when to roll the repair truck. Now, this is even more important with an N+1 redundant network, because a device can be down and you won't know it because the network stays up when one device is down. So it's important to monitor not just is data getting through, but the individual components. I've been at many sites where there was a network outage, and I went there. There was a router with 3 fans that could run on 2 fans just fine. The third was for redundancy. I got there and multiple fans had died because no one noticed that the first fan had died. I like to think of N plus one redundancy is you get one mulligan, and you have to monitor that so that you can detect that there's an outage and that you need to roll a truck.
All right, and now we've talked here a lot about network design and trying to find the optimal design, the right design for the right client. But there's also another question that may be less of a technical question, but it's, is the design vendor approved?
Often I've come to a site and been asked to clean up someone else's mess. And when I look at their design and look at what mess they're in, I realize that someone decided to save a buck by coming up with a design that isn't supported by the vendor, and it's not supported for a reason. They're breaking some rule. And sometimes the mess isn't a major mess. It's just, gosh, when we call the vendor and ask for support, they can't help us because the design isn't conforming. A lot of vendors nowadays will be involved in any kind of major design and make sure that you won't, and any recommendation they make is going to be an approved design. When you're reviewing resumes to hire people, what you really look for is someone who's dynamic and creative, and it would be great to say, you know, or to hire someone that says, oh, at my last job, I designed these amazingly creative networks. But actually, you want to stop yourself, and you want the opposite. You want to say, you want to hire someone who said, I designed many, many networks, and all of them were very boring. They were consistent. They were exactly what the vendor recommends. That's going to get you a much more reliable network and one that's easier to support, especially when you call a vendor support line. But the number one thing you want to hear when you talk to when you call a vendor support line is, ah, yes, that's our standard design. Let me help you right away. And not, you did what? Oh, well, let me get permission from my manager to see if I can replicate that in our lab and see what's wrong. Some common problems I've seen are just abusively complex routing structures where routing protocols are translated from one to another and then and back again. Ad hoc solutions to get connectivity to some distant part of a building. Maybe it's just, you know, feet out of spec for length limits, but people went with it anyway instead of using a repeater. Gateways between different protocols because there was a political issue in the company and you couldn't decide on just one, so they decide to build to support both protocols and have some kind of translator. And I've never had a good relationship with the translator. Protocols are just too specific and translators are imperfect. And the last thing that I see often is using PCs as routers. Yes, a Mac or a Windows box or a Linux box can be configured to be a router or a firewall, but it usually won't keep up with very high traffic loads. So it'll be great for the first couple months, but then you come back and demands on the network have increased and the bottleneck becomes this PC-based firewall. Worst of all is when I find a company with one machine that, like, and I see this at small companies often, one machine that's both a firewall and a file server and an email server. The problem I see there is that if I need to reboot that machine to fix, say, the file server, then the company is also going to lose internet connectivity because it's also their firewall. And it's really unacceptable to tell a client, I'm sorry, your whole company is going to lose internet connectivity because it's something unrelated to the internet. So I prefer single-purpose devices rather than one box that does many different things.
All right. And the final question, Tom, really would be, now we're at a point where we've, as a service provider, we've looked at the network design, we've looked at what's optimal for the client. We sort of have an idea of what we want to do. But then the final question really would be, how do you protect the network?
When most people hear, how do I protect this network, they think about firewalls and their connection to the internet. But protecting the network is something that needs to be thought of through all parts of designs, and it affects more than just how do you connect to the internet. Security really can't be an afterthought. For example, yes, there should be a firewall. There should be a firewall between the company and the internet, or maybe distributed firewalls, where you have a firewall in each office or multiple internet gateways, but also how do you provide VPN access? How do your road warriors connect back into the network? Are you doing it in a secure, encrypted way so that you're not exposing the company? But there's other protection issues. For example, how are your technicians going to connect to the equipment to do maintenance? Are they going to be typing passwords in plain text, or are you going to be using protocols that are encrypted? And if your technicians have passwords to these boxes, how do they share those passwords? Sadly, I've met vendors that use the same password for routers at every single one of their clients. And I think that's beyond not a best practice. That means if your technician leaves your company, there's possibly dozens or hundreds of clients that they have access to. Also, do you have some kind of password escrow policy? So are you, you know, anytime you do change the password, do you give it to the client? And there's issues about how do you give it to the client? Do you email it? Do you email it using an encrypted email client? Do you put it in a sealed envelope and put it in their safe? And then finally, security. How are you going to do security patches? So it used to be we didn't think so much about patching hardware because hardware is hardware, and now hardware has more software in it than a lot of our PCs. I mean, the very largest of the Cisco router products have a more complicated operating system than on my laptop. And these complicated systems need to be patched, and often they have high-priority security patches. So it's important to come up with some kind of security policy. Typically, machines that are exposed to the Internet need to be patched faster than other machines. So I've been at sites where there was an SLA created that equipment with direct Internet access would be upgraded within hours or days of a new patch, while the other equipment, maybe there is a monthly patch cycle or a quarterly patch cycle, or maybe the vendor was more risk-averse and just decided that the internal network equipment would only get a patch for either some kind of emergency or if there was a specific fix that was needed, and otherwise the software would just stay alone.
Well, that just about wraps up our questions for this podcast. Tom, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it and hope to see you again.
For more on network design, please visit searchnetworkingchannel.com. And for a text version of this interview, plus lots of related tips, guides, and expert answers, and as well as links to Tom's books, please visit searchnetworkingchannel.com/design. Thank you for downloading our podcast, and join us again next time for more frequently asked questions.